you started yours
too? Yep.
Okay. Now hold on a second. Let me just, I'm just going to do a level check here. I think that's pretty good. Bump it up like one notch here.
I'm at recording volume 0.63. You know, so.
Got a mic level 79 here. Okay, so why don't we, I wonder if we can do something. Let's try to do something like, let's both say 3, 2, 1, go.
And then hit record, or okay.
No. Okay. Let it record. At this point, just let it record. But this is just to sync it.
Yep.
So, all right, ready?
Yep. Three, two, one, go.
Go. Okay, hold on. We got to do that over again because that's
it's delayed or something.
We got to say it at the same time, I think. Is there a delay?
I don't know. We'll see. You ready?
Something's not right. Yeah. Okay, three, two, one, go. No, it's, I mean, I'm not getting...
I'm pretty clean here, so...
Something's not right. What's that?
Yeah, I thought that was perfect. To me, that was 3, 2, 1 at the same time. We were spot on.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, I could hear it perfectly.
Okay, then why don't we'll just, hey, you know what, the other thing we could do, here, I got an idea. Let's try this.
Maybe we can kick that track, and we can kill this track and start over, it doesn't matter. Because in theory, it's like you're using the Google Voice just for the translation, but you get a higher quality editing of Audacity. You just sync it. Like, there could be three people here, and it would be, you just sync all three levels.
That
makes more sense to me.
What's that?
To sync the voices later.
Yeah. We can sync the voices later. Can you just, like, clap one time? I want to just...
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. All right. I think we're going to... I'll let it go. And I think we're good to go. So how's it going?
Good. So it's at least we're down to actually trying something here.
We're trying
hopefully
something.
Hopefully we make it over that.
We're trying to make a podcast. I don't know.
And
it's still kind of an experimental phase, but it's kind of a cool idea.
And you know, the key here is getting over that hump that. How to start a positive addiction? We have to get over that 20 podcast hump.
Yeah, did you like? Did you like
really
that? I said
establish
that.
Yourself.
I read about that today. People were saying, seems like about 20. You know, most podcasts will just stop before they even hit 20 episodes. So we could, we'll try for it. We'll keep going.
So it will be a little weird since I'm not looking at you, but I'm staring at a screen, so I don't want to be distracted.
Yeah, well, you could. I'm gonna.
But it is nice to have some notes up there, and you're wondering, you know, what is the cleanest way to do this, you know, as a conversation, so I don't, you know, lose my train of thought or lose my focus of listening. So, what do you think would work best?
What's that? Just to have some notes on your computer?
Yeah, do you think, you know, like, having it open, but at the same time, I guess, yeah, you kind of got to just look around and have some, I'll have something to write with, too, and that'll be good.
Well, that's a good idea. Let me see if I can get a little writing utensil here in case we come up with something.
Let me grab something up.
I think it's, you know, I think, as long as it's, like, not too regimented in the beginning, I think it'll be more natural. One of the things that I think I saw some people saying that what was bad was to, I guess if your podcast was not authentic, and I wasn't sure what they meant by that, and I was thinking, well, maybe that just means that they had it like too perfect and too rehearsed and too staged.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I could think of, like if it's not authentic.
Oh, Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, we'll just see where things go. And, you know, I don't know how, you know, I don't know when people do their podcasting, when you're strongest mentally. I think with your profession, you can probably stay mentally, you know, on top of things at all hours of the day. Whereas I'm kind of probably like...
Yeah,
that's it. How about you? What do you think you're mentally best at?
Like, I was actually just thinking about this today because I was, you know, it's kind of funny because I'm like, well, let's see, it's later in the day and I swam and then I ran in the heat and then I had a beer and I was thinking, I don't know, what if I'm mentally flat, you know? And but I was reading that book, I think it was Originals by Adam Grant. I think I had mentioned it to you a week or two ago. And this guy says that if you're typically a morning person, you may have very good creative moments later in the evening. And it's something about how if you're just slightly fatigued, you might be open to different things. So, you know, not necessarily bad. I definitely do really well in the morning. Like, I read well after a good night's sleep if I do the first thing in the morning. But I mean, also used to, you know, staying up and studying. So, honestly, I don't know. It could be any time. If the conversation's good, I don't think it really matters.
Yeah. I'm, yeah, as long as I get... I'm wide awake, then that's fine. You know, you get into the habit of the, you know, whatever habit you develop. Usually I put my kids to bed and I start to get tired, but if there's something to look forward to like this, I think I could be mentally on again.
Yeah, and I don't think that I would be up for anything. I don't think you would be up for anything later than 9 o'clock on any given night. Unless it's like maybe like a weekend or something like that. And I'm usually going to bed pretty early, so... You know, 9 o'clock, or you know, even we can do earlier. We can even do mornings too, which is fine. Yeah.
Yeah, we could do a morning session. That would be good at some point, just to see how energized. If you're sitting there drinking coffee, you got some stimulants, and a lot of the other podcasters seem to be heavily stimulated. You know, or they're either drinking, you know, the Joe Rogan podcast, they're always drinking some type of coffee or some stimulant or some, just to keep that brain a little more intrigued.
Yeah, if you remember that Iceman episode, they were actually, the Iceman was drinking beer, like one after another.
He had beer too to relax, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that might be a good experiment, like, you know, I guess they have to figure out, like, how do you decide what is a good, like, what's a good outcome? Is it if the conversation is rich or if it's funny, or I guess if you subjectively feel mentally fresh? Honestly, I think it, you know, coffee could be good, and I think that, like, having a couple beers, it's like hanging out with your, you know, hang out with your friends, having a couple beers, it's always a great conversation.
Yeah, social relaxing or, you know, something along those lines. Yeah, that's right. I should almost grab a beer. But, yeah, so anyways, yeah, I like the idea that, kind of the M camp idea.
Yeah, and, I wasn't sure. Started getting a little bit, now I'm getting a little turned off because I was reading something.
Not to.
And I don't know, probably overthinking it, which isn't good, but I was reading that, I guess, like one... couple guys were saying, like, oh, you try to make it, you know, make the title specific so that people know what it is. But then there's, like, a lot of good podcasts out there that, you know, they don't have anything specific. They just have, it's like, you know, whatever, like Radiolab or something. I think there's probably a lot of examples of things that are, you know, not quite as specific. So I don't know. I guess it could work, MCAMP. I guess I liked it because it was more of an acronym, like Colin and Mike podcast, and then the M.
Yeah, yeah.
As you know, I thought it would be, I had this idea to maybe not come right out and say what the M was for the audience, but I think that the M was kind of important to you because you kept thinking, Well, there's this idea of the Mentat, which is this human, superhuman creature from the book Dune, which I think is kind of, so yeah, I don't know, that thing, maybe that, and I guess that would be, that kind of leads into our, I guess the next, my next question, which is really like, what is this all about? You know, what are we doing? What's the purpose of this? And I thought,
I think our goal is maybe to tap into our higher abilities, or what human potential is, and what, why do certain things interest us? Why do, you know, certain things disinterest us, and how to, you know, how to live a life of some type of passion for learning and bettering yourself and others, and, you know, just looking at life more in a positive aspect, but also being a realist, you know, and not getting caught up in this, you know, the standard issue, you know, news and politics, and trying to come out with some outsider perspective or something.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully we can get someone with you know, great ideas that we can actually speak with and ask questions to, and, you know, stimulate a conversation that's, you know, be on that person's level. That's kind of the goal. You know, can you hang on someone that, you know, just wrote a higher end book? Can you hang on their level in a conversation for an hour and learn from them? You know, how do you question without interrupting? How do you go about this properly? You know, that's kind of my, I'm just kind of brainstorming here.
Yeah, I like it. And I would add to that, I kind of like the, I sent you an email about some quotes from Viktor Frankl, because I thought, I think this book has got to be one of my favorite books, Man's Search for Meaning. I don't know if you ever had a chance, but...
Recent, or is it newer book?
This guy was he's a psychologist that was in a concentration camp during World War II.
Oh, okay.
So he was a physician prisoner in a concentration camp, and his you know, his writings and his revelations were, you know, pretty amazing. It's just like full of really amazing quotes, and I guess what the thing that I always liked about the book was that I think as long as humans have been writing and recording history, they've always kind of had this question, like, what's the meaning of life? And I think he kind of flips it around to, like, you know, that's your question, is to try to figure out, like, what gives meaning to your life? And I guess it's different for everybody, but
so what gives meaning rather than what is the meaning?
Yeah, like, what's the meaning? It's different for everybody. And I like it because I feel like, you know, maybe this is, in a way, this could be a way for me to try to help answer that question for myself. Because, I mean, I have, like, we both have, you know, we have our occupation and we do what we do and we have our families and stuff. But I think that I'm always kind of trying to think, you know, on another level, like, is there... You know, is there more, or should I be providing more? Kind of always like questioning, you know, what I'm doing and what my real purpose is, and so I think is helpful about either writing or blogging or maybe a podcast would be to sort of clarify my own thoughts and my own questions. So that's just kind of everything that you said. But then this is kind of like a little bit extra of some stuff that I thought about, and maybe the maybe this will, you know, we come up with something that is, it can be shared and that it's useful.
Yeah. So yeah, I like I like the fact that, yeah, we're trying to find what gives meaning to people, you know, in all kinds of different aspects, and I think when people are passionate about, you know, what gives them meaning, and then it leads to interesting conversation, and yeah, you can become a good listener then. Like, if somebody's passionate about something, you know, it sparks an interest. I think that's why people listen to podcasts or read books or watch YouTube videos, you know, or motivational speakers, you know, to see, hey, what's giving this person meaning? How can I take a little chunk of that, and, you know, or add something to it? And I think I kind of also like the idea in life of, you know, one quote I recently heard maybe a couple of years ago, and I kind of stick to it, is, you know, specialization is for insects. So, you know, just because you might be an anesthesiologist, you know, doesn't mean you can't be interested in something completely irrelevant from what you do for a living.
Wait, what was your specialization?
In our society, the quote was, specialization is for insects. So my theory is, you know, I think, you know, having that well-rounded or overall interest in all different kinds of categories. So, you know, kind of a Renaissance man, look on life, you know, in today's world of ultra specialization in so many different facets, can you still be a generalist? And I think it's to be a generalist is important, because you can see the big picture then, and you don't get pigeonholed. And you can think outside the box. So that's what I'm always I like to challenge myself and question what I'm thinking, I think, you know. So how do you do that? And that's why I think you kind of seek out all these different authors, people, all this new information to find that answer.
You know, I always kind of worry that sometimes I spread myself too thin, and I kind of take on too many things. Like, I've tried lots of different sports, and I'm kind of always switching around, and I know that some of the people that become, like, really, really great at some stuff are, you know, tend to stick with one thing, and then they get really good at it. I mean, not everybody, of course. There's examples where they have, like, they have a, you know, combined disciplines then leads to something new. But sometimes I worry that I'm, like, you know, I don't know, doing too much. But I think there's value in that. I think that, and I like what you said about, you know, being a generalist. It's kind of funny, the specialization is for insects. That's, it does make me think about, like, what my own work, and I'm actually very specialized right now. I'm just taking care of really sick, you know, babies having heart surgery. But I know that if I only do that, then that's not good, because I really lose all these other really important skills, which are important in taking care of all these other patients. So I think, you know, the last thing I need is to get pigeonholed in my job. And, you know, maybe it's maybe that's something that is applicable to, you know, just outside of medicine. People got to be careful not to get too pigeonholed. Like, what happens if I don't know, let's say there's, like, a nuclear holocaust, or your plane crashes on a desert island. It's like, all of a sudden, if you're a computer programmer, and then you're out in the woods or on an island, you don't know how to make fire, you don't know how to do anything. Like, so I think it's good to have a variety of skills.
Oh yeah, that's I think, you know, maybe you're doing your Doctors Without Borders, you know, maybe keeps you, like, hey, I mean, you're getting patients, you don't have to worry about all the liability, hold harmless stuff, and you could, you know, you could be working with some type of amputee, and the next thing you could be, I don't know, you could be doing, you know, doing something that you normally can't do at your specialized, you know, you're given those chances to try that. And I think maybe, you know, little breaks from the specialization like that can, you know, bring back some of those basic skill sets, so you don't kind of lose them or they go away. I don't know. Do you feel that?
Well, yeah, that was an interesting thing about working in Africa, is that I really had to, improvise, because we had, problems that I recognized that I couldn't solve, because I had either didn't have the right equipment, or we didn't have the right personnel. So for example, like, I spent a couple months in Sudan, South Sudan, and we didn't really have a surgeon. We had an obstetrician, but we had a lot of surgical stuff. And so I did a year of surgery before I did anesthesia. And so I was doing some minor surgical procedures that I don't normally do. And, yeah, I had to step outside of my, you know, I thought it was good for me because I had to step outside of my, my normal, routine. I think that's
comfort zone or
yeah, the comfort zone. And then my normal scope of practice, I guess is what I call it. And that reminds me, actually, I wonder if we have to like, just kind of briefly say who we are. I don't know if we even need to get into that, but obviously I did
no,
Doctors Without Borders.
We could touch on that a little quick. Yeah.
Yes.
So anyway, so you get out of your, you know, your comfort zone, and what is it? Necessity is the mother of all inventions. So I think that's the quote, but I'm probably off on that. But it's like,
yeah,
when your resources are limited and you've got to improvise, you know, and that kind of leads back to, you know, you kind of really get into that flow moment where you've got to rely on, you know, pure intuition and being in the moment. And would you quantify your levels of flow as higher in your Doctors Without Borders or, you know, a daily routine? I mean, you've got to be on because people's lives are on the line at all times. So I don't know what, you know, what would your situation be like? Would your flow be higher in Doctors Without Borders or at work?
I love discussions about flow. That's a good question. So flow, whether or not it was more time spent in flow because I was in Africa, I don't know about that one. That's a tough one. I mean, flow, from what I understand, it's typically where you lose track of time because you're really focused and you're doing your whatever it is, your the thing that you do. I mean, procedures, I get into flow and, you know, doing procedures and doing a part of what I do in anesthesia is like involves flow states, and then some of it's not flow states. I honestly don't know. You know, it was extremely hot. I could tell you that.
Yeah.
Maybe less. I might have been in less time and flow, but I can tell you that I was very happy. Like, I think I was. I found it to be some of the most rewarding medical work I've ever done, and I didn't really get a lot of sleep. I was on call every night. It was like 110 degrees.
Wow.
I was sick from the food. Yeah, it was like, it was impossible to sleep. We just laid in bed. I just laid in bed and sweat, and everything was just filthy, and people were extremely sick, and lots of death. Oof. And you would think that was such a crazy environment that it would be kind of like a miserable experience being a worker, but I didn't find that to be the case. I found it to be actually more, I was more, maybe the happiest I've ever been. And so I don't know, like, just, it was an interesting observation, just, you know, miserable working conditions, and yet I was happy. I mean, that just, you wouldn't expect that, right? I don't know what that is.
Externalities might have been stripped away.
What's that?
You know, like, you weren't bothered. You weren't bothered by maybe superiors or someone overlooking or malpractice or, you know, other stresses that you might not even realize are, you know, overlooking you in our society.
That's a good point.
And so you were free to just be respected for your skill sets, and you could then focus on doing your best and not worrying about the other stuff. And, you know, people make mistakes. We're humans, so, you know, it's going to happen.
I think it was, there was something that was good about really taking care of people that they had no other alternative. And so,
yes.
You know, I was kind of it. I mean, at least for my time there, like, I had, you know, somebody came in, there was a anesthesiologist there before me, and then there was one that came after me, but at that particular time, we just had our team, and then we were it for that that village or that region in South Sudan. So it, you really did get the feeling like you were doing something. Now, a little bit is lost, I guess, in the first world medicine, because you know, lots of times people they do kind of have a choice, and then there's all these like extra pressures, like there's time pressure, production pressure, there's legal, you know, liability pressure that I think kind of sour the richness.
Time, production, and legal.
What's that?
Would you call those the three? Is that medical lingo? Time, production, and legality? Those are kind of the three cruxes.
Well, like time, production. I say production pressure because you have to work quickly. So, like for example, there's I don't know if I think a lot of medical people will have this, but I feel like it's really exaggerated in the OR because operating time is really expensive. You get a lot of people, and a lot of people are working in the operating room. You bring a lot of people together that all have to be paid fairly, you know, whatever they get paid, fairly high pay. So, and then the patients have to pay like a rather high rate for, you know, every minute that they're in the operating room. That's a lot of time. So there's pressure to do things fast, get the work done,
yep,
do a surgery, and then kind of get the next patient into the room, and that pressure is, you know, sometimes in conflict with what doing safe. Like obviously, like, you know, the faster you work, at some point you're gonna compromise safety. So, yep. And then there's the liability thing, which I think most people would understand, liability, like, you know, everybody makes mistakes in medicine, but you definitely want to, you know, be extremely careful and not have things go wrong. And then I think, what was the other one? Time. I mean, the time, I guess that was just the same as, like, production pressure. So, like, all that stuff can they all have their advantages and purposes, but they can maybe make they take away in some ways from the experience. It's hard to explain.
And there could be a way too with you know, like even in the book flow, you know, you could take that time, production, pressure, liability, and if you break those, you know, how do you find flow? There's only so much time. How do you make some flow out of production pressure? You know, you could maybe find ways to find some type of positive, even though there's, you know, it's a negative circumstance, you know, but to make the best of it.
That could be a podcast all by itself, is just flow.
Yeah.
And
oh,
incidentally,
yeah.
Incidentally, I want to say that I figured out how to say this guy's name correctly. It's Mahali Csikszentmihalyi.
You saying this? His last name is still.
It's like the Mahali. Well, again, if you look at it, it's like it's Mahali
Csikszentmihalyi.
Mahali, and it's like, yeah, it's kind of like the end of this of his last name is got. It's almost the same as his first name, but I listened to Finding Flow on an audiobook, and so, like, you know, the guy would say it over and over again, and I'm like, oh, so that's how you say it, because otherwise, if you just read the book, you have no idea how to say it. It's like, who's that guy? So anyway, Mahali Csikszentmihalyi. Yeah. It's kind of it's a great book. It's awesome. I think you were the one that first told me to look into that, but I love it. And I think that's like, I get some of my greatest moments of my life are because of being in flow, whether it's, you know, skiing deep powder or buttercream, as we like to call it, or doing procedures. Yep. Or, I mean, I'm sure you have, you know, working on cars, you probably could just get, you know, have nice, like, long periods of flow, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think I do. At times, I think I used to have more flow when I wasn't worried about time constraints of other things that needed to be done, where I would just could straight focus and not feel as if I should be doing something else. I think, you know, like, so hobby-wise, I don't spend as much time as I used to in the garage, like those flow experiences, fixing stuff, whereas I kind of get my flow now. I've always had a lot of freedom in my job at school. And now with kind of the, you know, the every day I'm always trying to, like, it's kind of an R&D situation, so that's where I get my flow, like whether it's learning something new for my electronics class or figuring something out or reading something new. I got CNCs, so learning new G-code and just keep running experiments over and over to try to figure, you know, procedures out and how things work and interact and, like, just keep failing, getting, you know, gaining ground, failing, gaining ground. And that's kind of how I get my flow now. Is
now, what is that? You know, tell me what this electronics class is with the experiments, because I don't fully understand that.
Well, it's just a basic electricity electronics class, so any kid can sign up for it. And you're just going to start with the basic concepts of, you know, everything from Ohm's law, how does basic concepts of electricity, how does it work? And then we get into kind of the whole Make magazine philosophy, so we learn by doing. And electronics components are extremely cheap to work with. So, you know, what does a diode do? What is a transistor? What is a 5-5 timer? What is a resistor? How do these things work? And how can you, like, take this component and add it with this and make this light blink? How could, you know, and why does it? You know, why does the LED only light in one direction? You know, how do you blow it up? Well, it can only take so much voltage. Well, how do we take 24 volts and run this little LED? Well, we have to have enough resistance. So, again, it's just, it's math. And then we get into cool things where we'll actually, we build a little foxhole radio. So, that requires no power at all with a toilet paper roll and a razor, a blued razor, which actually, I got the idea because I was researching.
Wait, this is a radio?
What I was researching. Yeah, we actually build an AM radio on a piece of wood with paper clips, some basic magnet wire, just anything. You could pull that out of any motor. It's just coated wire. Yeah, and it kind of blows people's minds because we build an antenna around the room, and I consider it, I call it like the barbed wire fence. Like, we're all POWs, and we got to listen outside. So, yeah, and then we, you know, basically I have a little, it's what's called a piezoelectric microphone that I stick inside headphones, like that you use for ear protection, so it's really quiet.
Piezoelectric.
It's the faintest sound.
I think I understand the meaning of that, which it means that you turn mechanical energy, it's a substance that turns mechanical energy into electrical.
Pressure. So pressure. It's like a crystal.
Yeah, well, that's mechanical energy, so it turns pressure into electricity or electrical signal.
You got it. Like, exactly.
Is quartz like a piezoelectric?
There's three or four different components. I couldn't tell you, like, three or four different versions that they use. So basically, it's extremely sensitive. So if you put a small voltage signal into it, it responds and actually changes shape. So when it changes shape, you're actually bending sound waves again. So you're vibrating those sound waves. So you'll get a small, you can hear that sound, that change.
So what's the thing that you put in, like, which piece is piezoelectric that you're using?
It's just a piezoelectric buzzer. Like, so it would buzz in, like, an alarm clock or something. Yeah, it's a little, like, 90-cent part that you can get. I mean, it just has a very small, almost like foil, piece of foil over the piezo that kind of vibrates the sound wave. So it's very, very minute. It can pick up, it's very sensitive. So that's kind of cool to say, like, hey, this is picking up. And the first time people do it, you know, like, you know, it's pretty like, whoa, what's going on here? And then in order to make a diode, we actually use a razor blade and we blew it by using a propane torch. So what it does is it creates a an insulator, a conductor, and an insulator. So you've got like a barrier. So you create a poor man's diode. So that's again like kind of that where we get back to that, you know, necessity. You know, like what can you make? You know, we have all this fancy stuff, but yet it's still exciting to pull a radio signal with a toilet paper roll and wrapped with some magnet wire wrapped around it. You know, stuff like that is exciting. And then, you know, how does that work? And then you go on to the next one. But a lot of my inspiration comes, I think, from, you know, reading. I got a lot of technical books. And then, you know, I think the Make magazine and the Maker movement in the last 10 years has been a pretty big deal. Because I think in the tech ed world, we're always project based, and it's neat to see like kind of a national scene of people figuring out how to hack things, you know, I like conversions. So how do I take, and one thing I'm working on right now is, you know, the old rotary dial phones.
Yeah.
So that you used to have, you know, we grew up with those. Nobody hardly knows those anymore. But, so I've got to take apart a rotary dial phone, and it's based on, each number is based on how many times it spins a coil per second. So, like, I can't tell you the exact math. So, let's say you pull a three. It's like tick, 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 tick. And so you can actually have an Arduino for $20, an Arduino programmer, and you can program it to sense through those three clicks. So you could actually have a keyless entry to your house with a rotary phone. So, again, it's like taking old, mixing with modern.
Yeah.
You know, I get it. That's kind of
cool.
To me, that's just like fun little challenges that I get excited about, like kind of MacGyver hacking style stuff.
And where do you get the ideas? You said there was it's like in a magazine, or I mean, I know it's from the class,
Magazine.
What's that?
Yeah, Make Magazine has a lot of those hacking ideas.
Okay, so it's called Make.
There's quite a
Make Magazine.
Make Magazine.
Okay.
Yep. And
I gotta check it out. That's cool.
And then
cool. Sometimes
it's cool. Yeah, and there's all kinds of cool projects like you can build with your kids or by yourself, or people come up with their own idea. You know, we build one sometimes three string guitar, so we'll actually wind our own pickup coils, with you know, it's a simple magnet and thin 42 gauge wire and wind 800 to 1200 turns around a magnet, and then it can actually pick up a signal then, and you know, then we amplify the signal. And so just little stuff like that. That's just the one class with electronics, and to me it's a pretty gratifying class, and I enjoy that a lot.
Hey, that's
I get a lot of satisfaction.
Cool.
It's something new to learn.
I think I'm gonna have to check this out. I've got to see the radio in action though, because that's pretty cool. That's good.
Yeah, when you set it down on a table, it's pretty much like, what? That isn't a radio. Okay, so you hook it up, and there it works. You know, so it's pretty interesting. But to get back, you know, I think
what if you get podcasts without electronics?
Oh, yeah,
it might be
can and a string.
Yeah, I don't know how you.
One floor away, we could try it.
We have a podcast, but no electronics. We sit around the campfire, so you have to come in person. It's like it's a non-electronic podcast, so you have to show up.
Yeah, we're still waiting for people to show up. It's like an SNL scene.
Why is, you know, like, why
200 podcasts in, but nobody comes to the campfire?
Yeah, we have 200 podcasts, but we don't have any listeners yet.
It could take off.
Why is it so popular? Like, podcasting is just going,
I don't
it's
know.
Just crazy.
I guess everybody's
got something to share.
You're restricted,
right?
In the radio, but you can, yeah, they got something to share. But the thing about a podcast is you can't fake it. And you get used to maybe someone is a great interviewer. I mean, a lot of it comes down, I think they're really interviewers. You know, they're having a conversation, but at the same time, they're letting that person, they're they're bringing out the most they can in that 45 minutes to 3 hours, whatever it is, the podcast length is, of what that person can get across. And so I think people listen to podcasts because they are interested in some person or some theme. Again, you're only seeking out maybe what you're interested in. But if you like the podcaster, the guy that does it, so let's say you like Joe Rogan, you might just listen to a podcast that you don't really think you're going to listen to some guy that's the best bow hunter in the world. Well, yeah. Why do I want to do that? Well, he's going to talk to him for 3 hours about this, and then all of a sudden you pick something out of it that you got to challenge yourself to, like, I think, to listen to something that's completely out of your realm. Like, I don't know. I think that maybe that's... I like that a podcast is going to be good enough to get you to listen to something that you are not interested in. I think that's when you really hit the level of a good interviewer, a good conversationalist. Think so? Or what do you think makes a good podcaster?
No, I think so. Well, I mean, it's the content, I guess the subject matter would be the first thing, but then of course it's brought to life. Like I like that guy Wim Hof is a good example, and he's just a fun guy to listen to. He's just he's got a fun, his Dutch accent. He's just fun to listen to. And I guess what I like too is that, with 3 hours is enough to really get into the fine details. And I think that he got into this ice diving or swimming in the cold water because I think he, did he lose his wife? I can't recall.
Yeah. Something. She committed suicide.
Right. That's what it was. Right. So that was something that was so intense, and so then he got into it. But when you actually get to hear him say it, it's like, that real, that was real. And that was like, you really felt something powerful when he talked about losing his wife, that, you're not going to, you can get that, I guess, from a TV show, but, I guess it's different because it's really
you,
real.
You don't have that. You don't. He does. You don't have that time frame. You don't have that cut to commercial.
Yeah.
You have this open conversation. You have that. He has the time to say that. Like, TV is about concision, and we're moving away from that. Like, you can't. I remember reading once. It was, I think Noam Chomsky said it, the one who throws the mud always wins in TV, because you could just say, like, that guy's a terrorist, he's a communist, he's a socialist, he's a Nazi, and then cut to commercial. Well, how do you prove in 30 seconds that you're not? But in 3 hours, you can pretty much, or an hour to 3 hours, you can understand where someone is coming from. And I think that's what people respect about podcasts is, you can really kind of get to know that person.
Yeah.
In that sense of a time frame. I think that's what draws people, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's also that now it's really the ability to sort of, for anybody at a very minimal cost, to just start up a show and put it out there and reach the world, I think is kind of an amazing thing. I mean, 10, 20, well, maybe not 10, but 15, 30 years ago, if you wanted to have a show, it had to be on the radio or on the television. And so that was highly limiting. Nobody would, you'd have to really want to do it, and it was extremely hard. So there are, I guess there's like a downside, which is, there now everybody can do it, so there might be a lot of bad podcasts out there, but people tend to, the good ones will rise up. So I don't know. I think you're right. I think the content's got to be interesting, and I think the interviewer's got to be interesting. Now, one thing I had learned about was not to make it too perfect, and I think that by that they meant maybe not too rehearsed, and then not too much editing. I hear some people will take out all the, when they say or and or all the things that may not sound very, it may not sound good. I listened to myself actually when I recorded a podcast for my anesthesia fellows, and I listened to it, and boy, I didn't like the way it sounded. I seemed like I was stuttering, and but everybody else that listened to it, they said that they liked it. So I think it's dangerous, and I think that the podcasters out there will say perfection kills podcasting. So it's got to be a little bit dirty, a little bit rough. So some mistakes and a little roughness, I think, is probably okay. And I think if I could take that take that back to what you were saying about being an interviewer, I don't know who the perfect interviewer, maybe he may not be like the greatest interviewer, but if he has enough time, you know, and then asks enough questions, I think eventually that information comes out, and it comes out, and I think it highlights the person's unique personality and their background. And you and I have like these really interesting backgrounds, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely combining the two with your knowledge in more of the biological living field and all your experiences versus mine and the
doctoraling,
physical, doctoraling, and mine and the more mechanical toraling.
Would you say you're
that lens?
Are you a mechanical engineer? How do you? How would you classify your? I have to. You have to forgive me because like, I actually.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I know you. You know you're a teacher. But you're also a mechanical engineer, right? I mean, you know how stuff works, and you know how to build things.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a mechanical engineer. My degree is in technology education, so you know, basically, I've got to be a jack of all trades. So we used to laugh and say we have to teach everything from molten aluminum to websites. So there's really no like, again, that's like the specialization, or you know, I have to be a generalist, but I become specialized once I get down into the different curriculums that I have to teach. So whether it's automotives or machining or welding or electronics or power mechanics or graphic arts and printing, or you know, like it goes all over the board. So that's what makes it interesting, I guess. I'd probably be,
what about electronics?
Kind of like a bad teacher in his. Oh, what do you mean electronics?
And what about electronic music?
Ooh, electronic music definitely interests me. You know, I guess we kind of have similar music tastes.
I've been trying for the last couple of years to learn how to create electronic music. It's one of my little side hobbies. It's not easy to do. I mean, in a way, in some ways, it's the easiest thing to do. You have the software programs are so good now, but to actually make it really, really good and really unique is actually, I do find it to be difficult. But it's definitely fun. But I don't know. It's interesting. The technology keeps getting better and better, but you so rarely hear anybody as good as Kraftwerk. They started making electronic music in the 70s. I don't know how I totally like just dove off into another topic, but we were talking about.
That's what I like, and I think, you know, that one thing leads to another. So you know, on that tangent, yeah, it's like that's where you have to draw the line. It's like novelty and newer isn't always better.
Yeah,
you know, we're in search of that newer thing, that newer idea, which I think is important, but I think having respect for the classics, or just having that, you know, you know, that whether it's in medicine, you know, the what is the, you know, the ancient credo of, you know, do no harm, or I what is the main saying, the ancient saying?
Hippocratic oath.
Yeah,
Hippocrates,
you got it.
Hippocrates, yeah. And, first do no harm. That's your primary goal.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I think having a respect for the classics and then what is new, I think that's a balance in life that a lot of people are missing. You know, whether it's today's generation or our generation, or people are stuck on, oh my God, I got the iPhone 7. You still have the iPhone 4. How can you possibly know anything in this world? And I think what happens with that consumerism and the always having to keep up with the latest and greatest, whether, you know, you lose respect for what's timeless. So there are things that are timeless, I think that are worth caring about.
Yeah, right on. And I think it was this guy, Cal Newport, in his Deep Work book, also a really great read. But I don't think he coined the term, but he talked about it in his book, and so you have to forgive me. It was another person talked about a technopoly, and a technopoly is where, I think I got this right, anything that is new or high-techy is considered good and better above all else. And I think that that's how, right now, that's how we see people responding. Just like you said, the new iPhone comes out, a new app comes out, like that application or this program is new and sophisticated and is therefore good. And we, I think only recently have really, people are starting to really pause and say, hey, is this actually, you know, spending this much time on an iPhone, is this really good? Is this good for our brain? Is this good for our happiness? And I think we're finding out some really interesting things.
Yeah, and is that technology giving us time, taking time? You know, there's always a positives to it, but I think we've got to, maybe it's kind of, you know, my personal opinion, but we've got to be able to have that choice to say no. You know, you have to be able to make your choice. You know, like the Amish make a choice to pull themselves out of a current modern system, but they're really about 50 years behind. You know, they use, instead of using electricity, they use air power. So they have giant compressors that they run all their machines on air power. So they'll run a generator.
They're 50,
that'll run a compressor.
They're 50 years behind.
Well, yeah, they're about 50, you know, in some
so instances. They'll be listening to Kraftwerk in about 10 years.
In about 10 years. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, could we get the Amish to listen to Kraftwerk in 10
if we,
years?
Once the Amish start listening to Kraftwerk, then you know that, hey.
Bootleg cuts that they turn by hand on a record so that they get you, it's manually powered. That would be awesome.
Yeah. Oh.
So,
do you remember? You
know, they make their choice on, does it take away from the community or their general life? But yeah, maybe you could introduce it. I cried. You have some on records. That would be kind of an interesting experiment.
Yeah. I actually have a couple of old records from. I got a couple really old ones. The old one might be 1905. I might have some from the 1890s. I actually have a record called the Naughty.
Oh, I saw those. I saw the naughty 90s.
Yeah, the Naughty 90s.
But the 1890s.
Yeah, it was the 1890s, and was like printed. It was printed in like 1900. I'm not sure, 01 or 02, but I might have a couple that are in 1890s, but they're real heavy, and you have to play them at 78 RPMs, and not that many turntables out there will do 78, but my...
remember, I think they play like one song on a whole entire side.
Yeah, it's
right?
one song for an entire side. It's hilarious, and the record goes so fast.
So think about
fast.
That sampling rate, though. The sampling rate, the groove, if you think about it versus a regular long player 33, actually, I don't know if the grooves are thinner or the same, but you'd think you'd be turning that. There'd be more. It'd be more precise. Would it be more precise or not? I don't know.
Well, I don't know, but I know that those the records don't really skip. Where you know some of the newer ones, they get like a little bit scratched up. They skip like crazy. But these old ones, they're so heavy, and there must be like a deep groove because they're not really skipping. But they're made for a different needle. So I don't know if I'm ruining my needle listening to these things, but it, you know, it works. But it's pretty funny because you put it on 78, and you actually watch the record go around, and none of us are used to seeing a record go at 78. I mean, you know, more than twice as fast as the 33, and the thing is just hauling. And we have people over at our house, and I say, listen to this, and take a look at the record, and they're like, whoa, where is that from? Pretty funny.
Yeah, I think I was there when you bought. When you bought that.
I bought everything
of the oldest possible records ever in Ventura, right?
Yeah, I had a hard time actually walking to the car because the stuff was so heavy. I must have bought like 50 or 60 like old records, and I had a hard time carrying it. It's so heavy.
Have you found a gem or something that maybe nobody sampled yet in a deep electronic song like Dixieland Cuts? Or is there anything interesting?
I haven't gotten through all of them. It's a lot of it is classical. So I probably wouldn't say that there's anything, no real gems or anything, but it's kind of cool to throw them on and then listen to them. No, I'll have to keep looking. But it's interesting. I actually have a comment about what we were just talking about, where we're, you know, sometimes the new sometimes the new technology is not as good as the old stuff, like with the Kraftwerk example. So the software I'm using to make this electronic music is called Ableton. And
Yep.
Just recently, I was on the website, and I was downloading some new, they call them packs. I get some, samples and sounds and stuff. It was all free because I bought the software. So they have some new stuff, and people are talking about how great there's a new program, and there's all these new samples and new sounds. And so I'm playing with it, and I found that I didn't get any closer or in any efficient way to making any use out of this new stuff. In fact, I think it slowed me down and it distracted me tremendously. And I looked at, I wound up going to a tutorial on YouTube, and I saw that it was a terrible video, and it was absolutely terrible. They didn't say anything really helpful about how to use it. And then all the viewer comments say, this does nothing but distract people from doing what is most important, which is making, using their time to be creative and make music. And so it's interesting because you could kind of say, hey, as an analogy, I wonder if that's kind of like a lot of technology. It's like we're being distracted, and we may not be necessarily doing anything really good. We're just, you know, we're just like a little mouse in a maze. Maybe that's not a good analogy.
Yeah, like that's from the Dune quote that, you know, that you put forth. It says, once men turned their thinking over to machines and hoped they would set them free, that only permitted other men with machines to enslave them. So
I thought you'd like that. You know, I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite parts of that. And, you know, thou shalt never make a machine again to duplicate the human mind. I think it went too far. But, you know, this author that wrote Dune, he's writing this in the 1960s. This is pre, you know, personal computer. Maybe there's some supercomputers with vacuum tubes taking up entire rooms. Actually, there's transistors at that point, but it's like, to think that far out, and he's actually seeing what's going on today. And I see it directly with just students and people in general, and even myself. that unless I, you know, put restrictions on them, it's like the machines are highly addictive. You know, you
very addictive.
They grasp your interest, and you know, see, some of it's positive, but you know, in essence, you could be surfing the web into meaninglessness for hours and never bat an eye. I guess back in the day, we would maybe just stare at the TV and accept what it gave us. But, you know, now we have these choices. But again, we might have too many choices. I think that's one issue, is how do we narrow our choices? I think in this country, sometimes, you know, maybe if you're in a simpler culture we have so many choices that it actually, you know, becomes stressful. I just want to get a set of brake pads, or I just want to get a set of tires, or I just need to order the right microphone, and there's 500 choices.
Yeah, and it's,
you know,
and it's
stressful.
Yeah, and
it sounds stupid. It sounds like white people problems, or it's definitely a first world problem. Too many choices, and that's why I like that Cool Tools book. Someone did the dirty work, narrow it down. Someone picked my choices for me. I mean, that's why people used to hire an interior decorator or, you know, a personal assistant, you know, somebody that can help them, because there's too many choices. We can't possibly make all these, but, you know, we have to have time for those creative avenues, you know, if we're always trying to do these consumerist choices, you know, so make more time for your creative endeavors. I think that's one idea, too.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you mentioned like how addictive this stuff is, the apps, the phone, everything. It's all done very deliberately to be highly addictive. The marketers and the programmers have done it deliberately to get your attention. And it takes you have to have an awareness and then a lot of discipline. And there's a limited amount of discipline, I think, that you can have in any one day. So I found that I was actually did quite well when I went back to my, I did the Motorola Flip, or no, it was like a Nokia. I can't remember. It was a couple months ago. I have an iPhone and I've had one for a few years, but I had to take it in for a repair. So I tried something out for a month, and it was definitely frustrating. But I just wound up picking up I just would call people instead of texting, because texting was so annoying. Mm-hmm. And now it's like actually a hassle to call people. And I think, boy, you know, we're on a dangerous road here, where people are would rather not talk to other people at a restaurant, or they would rather not call someone because the texting has become the preferred choice. Really interesting stuff. Definitely, like, could be, that's a whole, yeah. I mean, that's, many books are dedicated to that topic.
And I think it's, you know, all these kind of issues have a long term, like, we're at the wake up point, I think. You know, the wake up point for kind of the revolutionists of this, kind of noticing this, might have been 5-6 years ago.
Yeah.
And now we're, you know, I think a little bit of mainstream's waking up. It's kind of like in the 80s, you know, let's fat is bad, fat is out, sugar's good, you know, processed food is cheap, it's healthy, all your nutrients are in it, and then, you know, fast food's not that big a deal. You can make a healthy choice on your own, and then all of a sudden the book Fast Food Nation comes out in 2000 and kind of slowly starts to change this perception. Well, 17 years later, good luck trying to get any junk food in any school setting. I mean, like, junk in terms of, like, sugar. People are starting to wake up. They're seeing what's wrong.
Yeah.
They're eating healthier. And now we've got this huge, you know, discrepancy, and you actually see it. And the poorer you are, the higher levels of diabetes, obesity chances, because of your diet.
Where it's actually...
You can't afford good food.
You can't afford good food. That's really interesting. They can't even afford.
Yeah, so we have food.
But if you go really poor, if you take it, this is the. I find this to be one of the most interesting observations. Is that okay? poor people in urban settings in the United States, and basically they can't afford good food. But go beyond that, go to a third or fourth world country, maybe not fourth world, but third world, where people are just eating kind of like rice and plants and stuff. They actually, that might be, that, you know, that's, in a way, that's actually healthier than just, you know, being poor in America. Kind of interesting. Do you see what I'm getting
for
at?
For sure. And I see, you know, again, that gets back into our distraction, which leads to maybe the straight thing is willpower. And I don't know who wrote it. Maybe it was Cal Newport wrote in some article. You know, we only have so much willpower in the
day. Oh, yeah, that was Cal Newport.
You know, some of us, was that Cal? Yeah, and some of us than others.
He borrowed it from somewhere. A lot of his stuff he's put it in his book, but he did have a comment on willpower, that you have a limited supply, and then
some of us have more than others, and I think maybe from time to time we should test ourselves in our willpower of something we really like. Like, I went like a month and a half without coffee, which I don't know why, but I did just to test myself, and it wasn't a fun path, and it took about a month before I really didn't care. And now I've slowly started to drink it again, and, you know, why not, I guess. You know, not a lot, but I did it just to see if I could, and that's kind of like something I probably am physically and mentally addicted to.
I think
you got to be on mentally in a classroom, and I just did it to see what my willpower was. And I think kind of the whole, you know, maybe in the Wim Hof and the cold showers, you know, again, that's like a willpower thing, or it's you.
That's
like
a tough one. I try
training
to do
for a marathon. It's a willpower.
I did not do well with the cold showers. I'm thinking about trying to make another go of it, but it is. I have an easier time actually just jumping right into the cold pool, like submerging myself. But to actually stand there with the shower where I know that I could just do a flick of the dial, and immediately it goes back to warm. I find that to be extremely, extremely challenging. And, you know, maybe I gotta give another.
Is that the willpower then? Is that, again, like, does that go back to the willpower, like endowed so much, you know, and like maybe everybody's got their willpower, they're stronger in certain avenues. I mean, your willpower to resist gruesome and terrifying, you know, medical scenes I couldn't handle, or, you know, fear of heights I have, so like climbing endeavors you do, like that's really pushing my
willpower. Well, but you kind of work up to that stuff, right? So I think that
I guess
you can kind of, like, you got yourself off of coffee, and, you know, like this stuff, like some of this stuff that you're describing doesn't happen overnight. Like, you know, I didn't just I see, you know, graphic stuff every day, but there was, you know, several years of college preparing for medical school and volunteering at the hospital, and then I became a EMT, and then, you know, then I worked at a hospital doing phlebotomy, and then I went to medical school, and then even medical school is like, you know, kind of like your first two years, you're not having a lot of patient contact, and so it's a very, very gradual, and I don't know if that, I'm not sure if that, how that relates to willpower, I guess, because, again, I think a better example is just kind of like, you know, if you're already sort of addicted to something, like, say, the phone or checking the messages or whatever, I would have to think that probably most people, if you factor out, or if you equalize it in a way, you know, standardize it in some way, I think people have probably a similar amount of willpower. I think some people have better habits. You know, some people know.
Yeah.
They're aware of their. I think that was maybe the main point, is that
maybe that's the awareness. Maybe people aren't. They're somewhat aware, but I think being that we're I guess, in our situation of where we come from and our class background, and like you just kind of we found that healthier path, maybe through basically education, self-education, and then, oh, this kicked me onto here, or that kicked me onto there, and where these people don't have that opportunity. They're kept, you know, you don't know that drinking, you know, 3 cases of Mountain Dew a week, yeah, it might taste good, and you get a little buzz from it, and you get some energy, but the long-term consequences, you know, just in terms of your sheer size, diabetes, you know, that you can get from this, I mean, either you don't care or you don't know. And then I think, you know, sometimes we make fun of these people, or there's a huge underclass in this country that maybe they're just not educated on the correct decisions. And they're being, again, we're kind of being given our stimulants
preyed upon, yeah, by the
food.
By the well, it's a big business, I guess.
Big business, right? Yeah. Sugar's cheap, so the poor have sugar, like Dr. Robert Lustig, you know.
Yeah.
The ultra-rich have their yachts and boats, and the middle class have some meals and maybe a second home, and they go out to eat, and the poor, what do poor people have? They got sugar. You can always go get an ice cream cone, a candy bar. You just go into, you know, if you need a cultural experiment, go into, I don't know if California has Walgreens, but
we do.
Walgreens or a Save-A-Lot of really cheap grocery store, convenience stores. Go to the gas station where people come every, you know, they're bored, so they walk in every 3-4 hours and they get a sugar hit. You know, they spend a couple bucks and then walk back home. I mean, it's cheap. You can get a hit on it. And, you know, it's destroying your ability to do a lot of things physically and mentally. And I think also, you know, kind of maybe we got into this realm because as you get to a certain age, you start to like notice changes in your body more. You're more aware of like how certain foods react with you. In your 20s, does it matter how late you stay up or what you eat? It doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, you really can get away with a lot. But I definitely noticed in the last few years that, well, especially now, I've got a couple really interesting observations with my training. I don't know if I told you, I've been doing it long endurance training because I got like an idiot. I signed up for an Ironman triathlon, and now that I'm actually doing the work, I can't believe how hard this is. But I've noticed a couple things with doing, you know, increasing my fitness and doing all this working out. My diet has actually changed all as a secondary, like, byproduct from the exercise. I crave the right stuff.
The right stuff now. Yep.
I just crave it. And part of it is because I've noticed that I know that if I have like some dairy or cheese or something before I do a hard swim, it's going to upset my stomach. So that's something that I do because I know I don't want to have an upset stomach. But I also am craving stuff just because it feels good. And then for some reason, this is the weird one, but I haven't really been craving the alcohol because I don't know, I guess I know that I may not sleep as well, so my workout the next day might not be good. And also, I'm like more sensitive to it, so I just kind of naturally, I backed off significantly on it. So it was really interesting.
You want that energy. You don't want to be down, right? You notice like your body, like, hey, I had 3 beers last night. Had I had 1, this run might be a little easier. So the pain the next day, you're realizing that, and you know, that's helping you crave the right stuff, like you say. That's a good, I like that term. Like, how do you reset yourself?
I don't know. It's like there's something more to it than that. It's something more like you're. It's on an unconscious level, like you. Because I feel like so after a really long workout, I feel like my body is just kind of buzzing all day. Like you feel good. Like, you know, you have a good kite surfing session. Well, I don't know, like you have a nice surf session, kind of want, like it's nice to follow it up with a beer. But I guess for some reason, like maybe the endurance training is different, and I don't know what it is, but it's on an unconscious level, I'm not really seeking out like an afternoon beer or anything. I want to hydrate and just eat like good food. I don't know. I think that there's more to it. We probably can continue to talk about that because diet and endurance training is definitely something that's on my mind a lot lately. That's pretty cool though.
If you listen to any of the podcasts with that Dr. Rhonda Patrick, I mean, she's out in the LA area. She's kind of like, I think a lot of it's kind of interesting. At least she's pushing some boundaries in certain things or new research and maybe not all of it's cracked up to be, but she kind of experiments with herself and, you know, gets different viewpoints from around the world. And I think, you know, I think it's very interesting what she's come up with. I've got a couple of interesting things I've heard from her.
Yeah, I listened to her one time on Joe Rogan, and I was...
Yeah.
I guess I found it a little bit hard to listen to her, and this is not a negative against her. I think as just because I'm a physician, to hear... I think I'd rather actually just speak straight, like, technical with her. Because I think what she was trying to do is she used a lot of, she was breaking down concepts for, like, medically lay people. And I found that I had a hard time with that. So I might have to try to listen to some of her other stuff. I'll give it a chance. But I do know that he...
Yeah, and like I say,
he likes to have her on the show, so... And I've tried to dig up... I'm not exactly sure what original
research she's done. She does a Wim Hof interview.
Does she have her own show?
I think, yeah, she does. She has a bunch of YouTubes that she goes around and interviews, you know, people doing different medical experimentation or diets or, you know, she had one interesting one, something that I forget his name, he had done with eating within a 12-hour window.
Okay.
And in terms of, especially for endurance training, and eating within a 9-hour window, basically getting back onto that circadian rhythm, you know, because if one thing we share in the entire world is light pollution and no circadian rhythm. Like, so, you know, obviously we're kind of humans running, let's say, 50,000-year-old or, you know, to whatever you want us to claim, 1.8 million year old software, you know, on 20th century hardware, you know, or something like that. Am I saying that right? Or would we be running the hardware with 20th century software? You know, it's so we've got these primal instincts.
Oh, we're
built
right.
to eat and live on a circadian rhythm, but we've been at full light pollution, you know, since, you know, for the last 120 years.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really, you know, if you go in space, there's no place. I mean, you don't see stars at night. You know, we're not in tune with that that primal, you know, connection anymore. And one of those, it's light pollution. That's why we're talking right now, because we can.
Yeah, I got all these lights on and I got my computer on. Yeah, it's terrible.
Yep. You know, so that's not natural. We should be asleep. You know, or, you know, like in the winter, we should be probably hitting the sack at 6, and that's just the way it would be. But we don't, because, so we extend out. But I think that one, she had some definite endurance training was good for eating within a 9-hour window. So even if you have your coffee, anything that the liver metabolizes, I thought that was an interesting, thing for training.
Okay, so let me understand this. When you say eating within a 9-hour window, does that mean you have... You have all your meals for the 24-hour period within a 9-hour window?
Yes. So let's say you get up in the morning and it's 7 o'clock.
Okay.
And you drink a cup of coffee right away. It's brewing.
Yeah.
She says anything that the liver, and then she's basing off another doctor's research. She does a nice long podcast. Anything that the liver has to metabolize, so whether it's a multivitamin, anything, then that's when the clock starts, and
well,
it shuts off at the last
meal. 7 o'clock to 4 o'clock, And that is a short
window. 7 o'clock to 4. So here's what you do. You get up and drink only water. Essentially just drinking water until you want to get to that first, you know, zone where you can really hit it hard and get a good meal in.
Yeah.
And then you can extend that 4 o'clock at night over to 7. So don't eat till 10, then maybe 7. But just try the 12-hour window. But the guy's saying even there's some slack, you know, if you mess up on the weekends, it's not that big a deal. But, like, if you can keep it within that 12-hour window, people are seeing a lot of, like, changes in their, you know, type 2 diabetes people and the way they're metabolizing. Endurance athletes are seeing a little better results. I just thought it was kind of cool. I experimented with a little, but it's kind of annoying.
I definitely, I'm up at 5 almost every day, 5 or 5:30. Yep. And I love to have a, you know, start off with a good cup of coffee. I definitely don't need to eat. I usually do because I know I'm going to be trapped in the operating room. And so I try to get a really, really solid breakfast in with my coffee so that I can kind of go a couple hours. But I think that I would find the biggest challenge to be, you know, we're usually eating dinner around 5:36. We're eating a little bit early because we have a, you know, young child. But I'm hungry again. And
you're hungry again.
Already, like, 2 hours after dinner. Well, that's the thing I think
most Americans are doing.
I'm not saying that I'm not terrible. Like, I'm not eating ice cream or all kinds of sweets, but I'm definitely pretty hungry after, you know.
Yep, I would be.
After an early dinner.
I can totally understand that.
Yeah, especially, like, I did, what did I do today? I swam for an hour and 15 minutes, and then I ran for an hour. Yesterday, I rode 60 miles on the bike. I was eating.
Oof.
I just wanted to eat, like, all. I don't know. I suppose that I might have mismanaged it too. I think that you're right. I think there's something to it, but I think that I might have mismanaged it. Because I even heard that after you finish a big workout, you really got to try to get refueled within, I think, that first hour. I think is pretty important. And then even the athletes are told not to eat, you know, not to be snacking too close to bedtime. So, yeah, I think it's interesting.
So that they get, and I don't know what the process is, what that last meal is, I guess. Yeah, I did for a while. I held off breakfast because we like to eat later. So you guys will eat earlier before the kid. We'll eat after the kids go to bed at, like, you know, almost like Spain, you know, like in Spain. You know, Spaniards, like, 9 o'clock usually we're eating dinner.
Yeah.
And so my window is way late then. So I got to, if I'm going to play 12 hours, I got to play, you know, 9, 10 o'clock for breakfast. So it's kind of annoying.
That is it. Yeah.
So that's hard to do.
Yeah. And we actually, so what we're trying to eat our meals with our daughter. And that's around the 5:30 time, and that actually feels good. Like, I like that. I could not do it. I could not go past 6 or 7. I mean, I would have to be snacking and then eating a big dinner late. I think I don't really like that either. So that's a tricky one.
Yeah. I don't know. Different culture. I guess it's what you get used to, but. I haven't seen any bad results, but I guess I don't do a massive endurance training anymore. I mean, I guess if I start doing the Birkebeiner skiing, I could monitor it and see.
Oh yeah, that's cool.
Training for that and see what happens next year. If I do it, I'll do the 9 and 12 hour windows and see, like, hey, did my training feel better? Just do it and see what your training feels like. You know, hey, well, did I feel better to have a little more energy on that run?
Well, on the next show, we got to talk about the zone 2 component to the training, which I think is, like, that's the coolest thing.
Zone 2?
Zone 2. It's zone 2. Yeah, 80% of what I do is zone 2. That's 80% of what the top athletes do are in the heart rate zone 2. So it's pretty low.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Now, so that, and that's pretty low, a pretty low heart rate. My zone 2 is about, let's see, it's like 110 to 125 on the bike. It's pretty
110 to 125.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I'm sure my zone 2 would have been higher when I was in college. But it's not good enough to just use that formula to figure out your max heart rate. Like, you can't just do 220 minus your age to get your max, and then that you...
No, no.
You know, that's a starting point, but...
You get somewhat close, right? The starting point, yeah.
Yeah. So I went ahead and actually got lactate tested, so where I was pedaling on a stationary bike... And every 5 minutes,
the VO2 max you did?
It's not VO2 max. It was called a lactate step test. So I was getting serial lactate levels drawn from a finger stick. Like, the guy was sticking my finger and taking blood while I increased the watts on the bike every 5 minutes. So my heart rate would go up. And then we were able to plot a graph where we can show the lactate levels at increasing heart rates and watts. And it's pretty cool. And once you have that information, then you know what your physiology is, and then you change your physiology by training predominantly in the zone 2. And it's been really cool. And I'd like to. I think we should jump into that next time.
I think I read a little bit about. Well, a lot of people, maybe it was Phil from that book from Chris McDougall, or was it Born to Run? And then he talked about Phil Maffetone, who trained all those endurance runners, and he trained them in that lighter heart rate. They trained lower.
Yeah, Phil Maffetone.
They trained lower, like you're saying.
What's that?
They trained in that lower zone, like you're saying.
Yeah.
I think that would sit. He was big into that, right?
Well, what happens is you get, when you spend a lot of time in that lower zone, you wind up just getting faster and better and at that heart rate. And so it doesn't really work, and I think, and this has been studied, but amateur athletes, like, let's say, for example, they want to do they want to qualify for a Boston Marathon, and they need to run, like, a 3:15 marathon to qualify for Boston, which is like a 7 minute 15 second mile or something, maybe 7:20 or something like that. So what they do is, without, and this is, you know, again, an amateur athlete who's not really they're not really, you know, studying or being coached or thinking that deeply about the training, but they'll go out and they'll just try to do these training runs at 7 minute miles or faster, and they have success up into a certain point. Once they get into their training runs up into the mid teens, and they plateau, and they don't get any faster. So they flip it. They'll Phil Maffetone's concept of doing more is, a lot of people call it go slow to go fast. So you slow everything way down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then what happens is the physiology is, your body is just really relaxed. Like, everything is easy on your joints, your ligaments, and you slowly adapt, and you get faster at low heart rates. Yeah, so you just keep getting faster and faster, but you're always adhering to your zone. Now, your zones do change. So that is something that you have to retest, and that's another reason why to be careful of those estimations. But it's pretty cool stuff.
All right, Mike. So
I was gonna conclude,
or we could keep going, or we could keep going in different directions here. But I think for a first one,
I was gonna say that's an hour and a half.
Get the audio and.
Yeah.
It was an hour and a half. Yeah, it went pretty fast.
It's pretty good, I thought.
And I'm about to kill myself in battery here, so.
I thought we covered a lot, and covered a lot of topics. We could, I might try to listen to it tomorrow, and, you know, we could talk about, you know, what works and what doesn't work. But, you know, it was fun, though. It was fun. There's obviously...
Yeah, yeah, I feel a lot better, too. You know, got my mind going a little more, and once I got a little warmed up and...
Yeah, yeah, I think it'll just get easier and easier, and I can already tell something for future is we covered a lot of ground. Like, there was all kinds that we would kind of jump from topic to topic, which that's kind of fun because that's kind of like that's real life. Like, we talk, you know, this, that.
Yeah.
But I think that for a podcast, I think you might try to stick within a little bit more of a narrow scope. Like, there might be a theme, you know, mm-hmm. you know, like the theme could be, like, we had a lot of different themes. We had, I thought that was pretty cool hearing about the, you know, the electronic projects, like the DIY projects. That could be like a theme, or the digital distraction, or food.
Yeah,
you could talk for like you do multiple episodes.
They all kind of relate. They all kind of slightly,
but they all,
to
but
each
they
other,
all do.
Know, and I think that's
they do kind of relate too. So I guess that's why it's tough to be too regimented.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but and, pretty cool.
You know, yeah, perfect. That was good. And you know, see, I'll send you the track, and then we'll see how the sound goes from there.
Yeah, shoot me an email, and then I'll play with it. So, all right, thanks, Colin. All right. That was good.
All right, sounds good, Mike.
All right, bye-bye.